So in each issue of The New Yorker, a cartoon caption contest is published on the last editorial page of the issue. We are infiltrating that vocabulary complex on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Be advised, we should abide by the official rules for the, air quotes here, contest at newyorker.com. This is me reading official legalese. The winner of each contest will be the person whose caption received the greatest number of valid, air quotes here, votes from the public and who satisfies all of the rules. Also, get this, void where prohibited, as in there's a state against New Yorker cartoon wit. Come on, lawyers. Join in on New Yorker cartoon captions, 800-642-1234. Paul Nesha of Mount Horeb has racked up 2 wins, 4 top 3 finishes in 3 years. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so your last winning caption appeared in the March 21st issue of The New Yorker. Can you describe what's going on in the cartoon?
That cartoon is of two dogs in front of a doghouse. One dog is speaking to the other dog. And the conflict in the cartoon is that the doghouse is incredibly tall.
And so what is your caption?
My caption for that was, it's got an indoor tree.
Mm-hmm. An indoor tree. So nice indoor plumbing for dogs.
Right.
a deluxe doghouse, if you will.
Right. It's something utterly ridiculous. It's not a good thing to have, actually.
So can you take us through your creative process, how you work through coming up with the caption?
Sure. One of the first things I do is I stay up late on Sunday night. That's when the contest changes over, about midnight. And I take a look at the cartoon and try to figure out something right off. Sometimes it comes to me immediately. I don't know how that works. It's like magic for me. And I'll enter that in the first 5 minutes of the contest. But if I can't think of something right off, I will, work the rest of the week doing that. What I'll usually do is I'll make a list of the two conflicts in the cartoon. For this last one with the dogs, one is that they're dogs and the other one is a tall doghouse. And I try to come up with two ideas that I can bring together to make that funny.
Every word matters, I would imagine, too. You have
every word. Yes, you have to have an economy of words. You don't want to have any extra words in there because that just makes it less funny.
Yes. So I noticed you can buy this cartoon as wall art, as a beach towel, a coffee mug, a phone case, a T-shirt, a face mask. You can walk around with your caption on your face. You know, I want to ask so many things here, but are there monetary benefits for cartoon creativity for The New Yorker?
Not really, not for me at least. I mean, if you're an actual cartoonist, that's your living. But for somebody who does this just capturing things, it's for the pleasure of it. And yes, when I win, I get to go and buy a coffee mug, which I am holding right now.
Are you really?
Yes.
Which one?
I've got the one. It's my first win. It's the pirates forcing someone off a subway train. And the caption for that is no one crossed the pirates of Penn Station.
So this is a pirate who's on the subway train making a blindfolded person walk off a subway car on a plank. And say the caption one more time.
No one crosses the Pirates of Penn Station.
Okay. Is this, and I'm just curious, is this a nod to Pirates of Penzance?
Yes, it is. At least that, when my original idea came up, I was trying to figure out something with Pirates of Penzance. And obviously, in my method, it's like, okay, I've got that in subway stations. I thought Penn Station, brought the two together, made a caption. So you got to find a common point to make the caption work.
Are you like fine wine? Do your captions get better with age?
Yes, I like to think so.
So we walked through a couple of entries, and I would imagine, you do this regularly, so you've probably put in some what you thought were true winners.
Yes.
can you explain one that you really wished had won?
Well, actually, there is one in a recent contest of a flying saucer in the middle of Central Park, and there's aliens coming off it. And the behind the aliens is what appears to be a lawyer or an accountant or something. And my caption for that was, it's not an invasion. Oh, I'm sorry. There are two people, an older couple, watching these aliens come off the spaceship. And the woman is saying, it's not an invasion. It's an injunction.
Okay, so so there are you know, thousands of entries each week, and they receive these votes from voters, from people online who are voting on these captions. So what do you have in mind there for in terms of this crowdsourcing effort for captions?
You enter your caption and you hope for the best. I mean, there's no way it's, I mean, there's literally 5,000-6,000 other captions in there. You just have to hope for yours to bubble up to the top of the list. That's how the voting works. The ones that get the most funny votes eventually bubble up to the top, and you start seeing yours more often. So, I mean, you just have to be funny and enter it. That's all you can do.
You just have to be funny. Or I'm going to reintroduce you here. Paul Nesha co-owns a letterpress printing business in Mount Horeb, and in spare time submits hilarious captions for cartoons in the New Yorker magazine caption writing contest. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Tom is with us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. What is your question?
Well, I have two things. I know a woman there are people who only buy the New Yorker for the cartoon, nothing else. They just, they've done it for years and years and years. And then the next one is, do you ever collaborate with people? Sometimes you meet funny people and you kind of bounce ideas off those people, and they're very funny people, and they kind of inspire you.
Thanks, Tom.
Yes, I kind of do that, actually. I'm a member of a Facebook page where there's 8,000 other people that are members of this Facebook page. And each week, we go on there and make comments on each other's captions and bounce ideas off of each other and just try to improve each other's captions. Sometimes I have to do that just because I'm coming up against a wall. So, yes, I do that occasionally.
It's kind of like some caption training a little bit, I suppose.
Caption boot camp, yes.
Caption boot camp. And you also, you can't get too attached to a caption because, you know, I would imagine, too, you have to be able to step back and say, well, you know, that one might not have been pretty good. So you can't get too full of yourself, I would imagine.
Yeah, there's sometimes I'll work. I think I have an idea that sounds really great at first, but there's just no way to word it to get it to work within a caption. So, you know, as much as you like that, you just gotta abandon it and go on to the next one. So yes.
Is there a sweet spot for the number of words you're working with?
Well, I wouldn't say words. There's characters. Trying to keep it on one line for the New Yorker would be about 35 characters. So there's that one, and then there's the next level of trying to keep it under two lines, and that gets up to 60 characters. So you want to try to get that nice-looking one-line caption.
I can just see the font right now. So I listened to one of your podcast episodes yesterday, and this is where you interview cartoonists of The New Yorker, and you talk about captions, and you talk about the creative process. What has that podcast done to kind of inform how you approach caption writing?
I don't think it's really changed my caption writing as much. A lot of what I do is it's reinforced by the cartoonists that we talk to. You know, they talk about their methods, and they kind of match mine already. So it's like, it's nice to know I'm going in the right direction.
Do you ever get any tips for them, ideas on the creative process, especially when you hit that wall, when you just don't have an idea? What do they do?
Everyone has a different idea of what to do here. Some of them just walk away and do something else for a while. Others, they keep files of their cartoons that got half finished, and they'll rummage those to see if there's an idea that they can put together with what they're currently working on. So there's a number of different ways to do it.
Have you found community through caption writing? Have you found a community through this contest?
Yes, I have. As I said, there's this Facebook page called the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest Rejects. These are people who've been rejected from the New Yorker for years and years, decades even. And so we've all gotten together and we commiserate, and you know, somebody comes up to the great caption that they think should have won, and it's like, and we all say, yes, that was a great caption. We're, you know, it should have won. And when somebody actually does win, it's like we're all very happy and we celebrate it. So yes, there's a nice community of people there.
Some nice therapy going on in that caption space. Well, Paul, thank you for sharing this with us. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, you're welcome.
Wisconsin's own Paul Nesha, a regular participant in the New Yorker's Cartoon Caption Contest, won the contest 2 times. Have you entered a caption or voted for other submissions? Do you wonder about how the funniest captions get selected? Join in at 800-642-1234. We're going to pick this up with a UW-Madison professor who created the algorithm that helps the magazine determine the funniest captions. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the New Yorker's cartoon captions and how they come to fruition, but they also take on a life of their own through crowdsourcing. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Robert Nowak is McFarland Bascom Professor in Engineering at UW-Madison. And nearly a decade ago now, he reached out to the cartoon editor of The New Yorker and asked, hey, could they use an automated system to sort and winnow the best captions submitted to the cartoon contest? Why? Yes, no laughing matter there. What do you think about AI judging or creating humor through artificial intelligence? Have you laughed at the answers you get when you ask Alexa or Siri questions? Join in 800-642-1234. Robert Nowak, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So you created this algorithm for The New Yorker, still in use today. How does it work?
So basically what the algorithm does is it collects these ratings. People can go to the system and look at cartoon captions that have been submitted. They have 3 options. They can say a given caption is not funny, somewhat funny, or funny. And our system decides which captions to show people when they show up to this crowdsourcing platform. And as the voting and starts and some of these votes and ratings come in, some captions start to be looking a little funnier than others. And we kind of push those towards the top of a sorted list, if you will. And the ones that are getting more funny votes will be presented to more people. So roughly speaking, the funnier the caption, the more ratings it receives, providing a more statistically accurate estimate of just how funny it is.
I'm thinking a parallel of a Google search and what appears on the first or second pages. Would that be analogous?
That's exactly right. So there, what would be happening is many people search on the same or similar terms, and Google keeps track of how many times a website that it shows in those search returns is actually clicked on and so forth. And so the search items that get more clicks are the ones that Google pushes up to the top of the list when you do a search.
How did you think to reach out to The New Yorker in the first place to say if they needed this type of analysis?
Yeah, so we were, my students and I were working on algorithms for optimizing crowdsourcing in rating and review systems like you'd find on Google search or other things, Amazon and so forth. And Bob Mankoff came to UW-Madison and gave a lecture. He was invited by some folks in the psychology department. And he talked about the psychology of humor. And my student and I saw that lecture and we thought, wow, that cartoon caption contest would be a really fun way to test and evaluate how different algorithms perform for these types of crowdsourcing activities. And I reached out to Bob and explained what our research was about and asked him if he could share a little bit of the New Yorker data. And then we did some small scale experiments just to evaluate, as I said, different types of algorithms for this type of problem. And Bob was excited about it. He thought that's really cool. He said we should do this for the real New Yorker contest. And that's how we got started.
Have you tweaked the program over the years? Have you adjusted the algorithms?
Yeah, we've done a few things. So it's a continual research project. We learned a lot through the New Yorker. It was a really large scale sort of application of these ideas. So that presented some software engineering challenges. We had to make the algorithm scale up to handle the large volume of activity that we see. There's a lot of people who are voting in this contest. We also improve the way the algorithms work, so they're more effective and more efficient, and also a little bit more robust. We put in some mechanisms that make it difficult for people to maliciously interact with the system. So it's a safer system, if you will.
How do you know they're fair and that they don't introduce bias?
Well, the system is only using the ratings that people are providing. So mm-hmm. The system itself does not look at the words or the actual captions themselves. And so we're simply looking at, you know, how many times did someone say a particular caption is funny or unfunny? And we're using that. The rest of it is based on, you know, statistical analysis, which is, you know, objective and as fair as you can make it.
Talking with Rob Nowak, who is a professor in the UW-Madison College of Engineering, talking about the New Yorker cartoon caption contest and the algorithm work that goes into the crowdsourcing effort. You can join in. Have you ever entered the caption contest? Have you wondered how the funniest captions get selected? What do you think about artificial intelligence helping to contribute to judging and creating what is humor? What is the caption? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Rob, how does the New Yorker's ongoing use of your algorithm work, how does that further your research into artificial intelligence and machine learning?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, apart from applications to things like rating and review systems, our research and experiments are also important for just some basic engineering and science problems. For example, our algorithms are also used by the Air Force. They're used by local businesses like American Family Insurance. And they're used by researchers here at the university who study human learning and decision making. One of the most fun projects and collaborations I've been involved with was in education. We used our machine learning system to study and understand how chemistry students learn to reason about visual representations of molecules. And this is something that can help us design and improve AI-assisted tutoring systems.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you work from the same place, whether it is AI in computer systems, whether it's a local business, whether it's, you know, it's working on a different problem versus, you know, cartoon captions? Do you take a similar approach to programming these problems?
Yeah, definitely, you know, common elements that come up. And, you know, basically we have data. We're trying to learn from those data something about the mechanisms that are generating the data. So in the case of the caption contest, we're getting these responses, not funny, somewhat funny, funny. And we're trying to understand, you know, and predict, if you will, what somebody will say. If a new person comes along and looks at a caption, we can predict what they'll say based on what other people have said. So this machine learning is, and AI using machine learning is about prediction. And so that's the common theme. We're trying to predict something based on past observations.
So by extension here, could this programming help make smart devices at home like Alexa and Siri who are telling jokes, you know, and other things? Could it help in those devices?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, something that there's a lot of interest in. Of course, companies like Amazon and Alexa want to be cautious, right? They don't want to have these systems do anything that would be inappropriate or offensive. So it's a delicate problem, right? I mean, humor is often operating at that edge of appropriateness and so forth. So yeah, there's a lot of activity in that area. Bob Mankoff, who was the former editor of the New Yorker Cartoon Contest we started with, he's been working with a number of people, including us, at that problem of trying to build AI systems that have a sense of humor or can assist humans in the generation of humor. And yeah, it's a really fun project.
Right, because there was this group of university students who tried to win the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest with captions generated by artificial intelligence. And, you know, this method hasn't produced a winning entry, but do you think that it one day will?
I think it's definitely possible. I mean, the way those systems work that they were using, these are machine learning systems. So they're sort of taught to make these predictions. And roughly speaking, what they do is, given a sequence of words, a sentence or two, these systems are trained to predict the next word that will come out. And we can just take all of the text documents off the web and train these systems just to try to do that next word prediction problem. And this is what these systems have been trained to do. And then people can just insert like a prompt to the system that would say, I'm looking at a caption that shows or depicts this scene. Can you think of something funny to say about it?
Mm-hmm.
And they can, you know, the systems produce something that seems a little bit funny sometimes. Mm-hmm. But we've been working with taking all the data that we've collected from the New Yorker and then actually going back and retraining or fine-tuning these systems a little bit, and we can get them to actually start generating fairly funny captions automatically. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of potential there, but we're just kind of starting on those projects.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us and for explaining this work.
My pleasure. It's been fun to talk with you.
Rob Nowak, professor of engineering at UW-Madison. Earlier, we talked with Paul Nesha, who regularly submits his caption efforts to the New Yorker. We have a link, by the way, to the caption contest. It's at wpr.org/mornings. And ahead this hour, we're in conversation with the UW System Board of Regents President, Edmund Manydeeds, overseeing Wisconsin's public universities. What do you want to know from leaders who oversee the system's universities across the state? 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. We have the president of the UW System Board of Regents on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Attorney Edmund Manydeeds was appointed by Governor Evers in 2019 and is serving a second seven-year term. The regents, they consist of 18 members responsible for establishing policies and rules for governing the system. Next meeting set for next month at UW Stevens Point. Are you a UW student or employee? What do you think leaders of the UW system should know? It's 800-642-1234. Region President Manydeeds, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, starting with the appointment of the UW system's ninth president, Jay Rothman, June 1st, Board of Regents selected him from outside the system as a Milwaukee law firm CEO, replacing Tommy Thompson. What do you hope he brings to the job?
Well, I think that he is going to bring years of experience in running one of the largest law firms in the country as its CEO for the past several years. He is going to bring his roots as being someone that grew up in Wausau, Wisconsin, someone that started off working on a farm that his parents had, someone who is knows what hard work is and knows how to be successful. I think that you will find once you come in contact with him that he is a great listener, which I believe is one of his greatest attributes, that he forms opinions after finding out all the information that he believes is necessary for him to do that. He will bring to the table organizational skills. He'll bring to the table that listening, finding out what he needs to find out, and then working as a group, a team, to come to a solution for whatever the problem may be. That's what you're going to find out about Jay Rothman. Obviously, he's brilliant. Obviously, he's successful. But there are things that make a great leader, and he possesses, I believe, most of those things.
Not from the academy, not a background in campus-based academia. So what do you tell your doctorates, your terminal degree folks who raise an eyebrow to that?
Well, I don't know that we've had any eyebrows raised. I can tell you that we've had a lot of positive feedback on this. I think what everyone that was involved in the search and the selection of Mr. Rothman, which were quite a number of different groups. I believe in shared governance, and we're successful in using that time-honored method for selecting Mr. Rothman. They are all interested in change and a different perspective, someone who may not have been from the system to give it a different look, maybe, to look at things that work or may not be working so well, and to come to a different way maybe of doing things. That was expressed to everyone on the search committee as being something that was desirable. And Mr. Rothman certainly fits that bill. He impressed each and every one of the shared governance groups that interviewed him at length. And so I don't know that we have that many eyebrows raised. I think that you will find that people are going to be very happy that he's our president starting June 1. And we're not going to have any eyebrows or problems.
Okay, no eyebrows. Right. I can dig that one back. So let's talk about what he is walking into. Outgoing system president Tommy Thompson, former governor, has called for a blue ribbon task force to study higher education in Wisconsin. And I'm wondering, what are the UW system's most pressing challenges? And would you support a blue ribbon task force?
Okay, well, let's take those two questions. The first has to do with the Blue Ribbon Task Force. That has been discussed and talked about by many different groups, including Governor Evers, who's expressed an interest in having such a task force formed to look at our Wisconsin education system as it relates to the higher levels. I think that I would support something like that. I don't think it hurts to have us look at what our systems, what our two-year campuses provide and how they provide it. And I think that it's something that we should do. And so I'm in favor of that. I agree with Governor Thompson regarding that being something we should do. Second part of the question, what are the issues? Well, that's something that we could probably talk about at length.
Mm-hmm.
I think that someone that's coming into this is going to have to gather all the chancellors in the system together, which by the way, we're doing. We have a committee that's set up to help Mr. Rothman transition into his role, and we meet weekly. So he's doing that, and he's a very quick learner. But the issues are going to be obviously funding. The issues are going to be enrollment. The issues are going to be equity, diversity, and inclusion. Those are just some of the ones that come to my mind. There are always going to be issues regarding, I believe, into the future, COVID, and maybe those sorts of things that spring up from it. There's always seems to be a new variant. We want our students to be safe and healthy when they come to our campuses. And Governor Thompson was excellent at that, at doing that. And we hope to continue that into the future. So Another thing that I think everyone on the Board of Regents and Mr. Rothman will be concerned about is the mental health of our students and faculty and everybody else that's involved in the system. Very, very important issue for us to not overlook.
Well, let's pick apart and take some of those things one at a time. The second thing you mentioned, enrollment. Enrollment has been falling across the UW system in recent years. And Wisconsin, as you're well aware, has an aging demographic. Are there some campuses in danger of closing, or how do you deal with that falling enrollment?
I don't think there are any campuses in danger of closing. I think the way we deal with it is to look at the underrepresented populations of our state who have a lot of people in the area, in the age group that are going to be able to go to college or will shortly being in that position. And I think we should make it something that is more accessible for those groups. There are many, many students that we could benefit from, the state could benefit from having their expertise and gifts that they bring into life to receive an education. And I think we should make education more accessible for those groups. I think we should continue to market and showcase the University of Wisconsin, because it is a great system and it has great accomplishments. And Governor Thompson was a great cheerleader for that, with good reason. And I think Mr. Rothman will be also. You can't help but look at each campus and the thing that it brings to each region as far as being a benefit and a partner with the region and the businesses that are found in those areas where those campuses are. I think if we keep showcasing what the UW system and each campus brings to the state and to that region of the state that the campuses are located, that you can't help but realize that this is a economic engine that generates a lot of income and is good for us and it's good for our students and it's good for our communities in the state.
So you're saying that marketing and recruitment campaigns could be really bolstered here to be able to drive more students to UW campuses?
Well, I'm not saying that they're not doing that now. Don't misunderstand me regarding that answer. My answer is that we should continue to do that. And if necessary, jack it up a little bit more as far as telling everybody the benefits of an education and that it's available to them. Many people think, especially from different communities, that they will never be able to go to college, that it's something that's so far out of their range of thought that they can't do it. And I think we should change that narrative and make those groups think, yes, you can go to college. It's available for you and you should pursue it. I think that's something that we can do and are doing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the UW system with Board of Regents President Edmund Mini-Deeds, and you can join in. What questions do you have for the president of the UW System Board of Regents? What do you want to know from leaders who oversee the system's universities across the state? Are you a student or an employee? What should leaders know? 800-642-1234 to join the conversation. As you look at programs to bring in students, we've talked on our show about efforts to expand access to Native American students, improving instruction around First Nation subjects, UW-Madison in particular, its history as a land-grant school. How can the UW system better serve its Native American students? It's serving, how can it better serve its staff and partners?
As you may or may not know, we were very, very happy this last December to have adopted an agreement with the tribes, the sovereign nations of the state of Wisconsin, to consult with them about this very issue. And so we have in place a document which the sides that are involved in this, that is the sovereign nations and the university system, have agreed to meet on a yearly basis to talk about issues that impact the tribes and their students. The main focus is trying to have Native students go to college here in the state of Wisconsin, to retain them and to graduate them. And there are a lot of issues that are not unique just to that group, but that we need to consult with them about. And I think that's for many different reasons. You mentioned that Madison is a land grant. It sits on the traditional lands of the Ho-Chunk. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you go on the campus, there are effigy mounds, which are sacred to them. It is a holy place. And it is just now being recognized within the last several years as being such. And so we need to do more of that to make the Native students feel welcome and that they can come and be successful. There's a background to this, which you may or may not be aware of. For many years, students were taken from their families when they were little, and they were put on Native American boarding schools, which the federal government ran, and they were not allowed to practice their religion. They were not allowed to speak their language. They were not allowed to have traditional hairstyles or dress. And the effort was, I think, well-meaning, but was failing, was to incorporate them into the culture that was the dominant one at that time, and make them part of it by teaching them how to be part of it when they were little. It was disastrous to family units, and because of that, Native American family units are very, very protective of their students when they get to a certain age and whether or not they should go away somewhere to school. You might be able to understand that fear. And so while it's getting better, we still need to work on it and make sure that the students and the families understand that we want to make it a place for them to come. We want it a place for them to feel safe, just like we want all our students to feel safe. And we want it a place to be where they can feel comfortable and learn so that they can obtain a degree at one of our campuses and use that to become successful. And if they would like to return to their tribes and do that. That's not the goal. The goal is to get them educated. And we want to work with the various, for instance, the Great Lakes Intertribal Council and other groups and other tribes that are interested. And they, by the way, they all are interested, and they're all glad that we've made this agreement with them for their students to come to campuses and be successful. Mm-hmm. If you look at our statistics, the number of Native American students on our campuses is extremely low. It's embarrassing.
Fewer than 1%.
Students that stay and graduate is even more embarrassing. And so the aim is to change that for everybody's well-being.
President of the UW Board of Regents, Edmund Minihans, stays with us. What do you think he should be knowing about your top priorities for the UW system? What challenges, what opportunities do you see in the months ahead for higher ed in our state? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Regent President Mini Dietz here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're in conversation with UW System Board of Regents President Edmund Minihans. His service on the Board of Regents has spanned three governors, from his initial appointment by Governor Jim Doyle in 2010 through the election of Governor Scott Walker, and then his reappointment in 2019 by Governor Evers. He is the first Native American member of the Board of Regents, member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. What do you want to know from leaders who oversee the system's universities across the state? Still time, 800-642-1234. Regent President Minihans with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Saul now in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. It occurred to me that immigrant groups tend to hold education in very high esteem, and I'm wondering what the board and the university system are doing about recruiting from the many immigrants that have come to Wisconsin, especially most recently the Afghanis, and I'll bet there'll be a lot of Ukrainians arriving soon.
President, go ahead.
Well, I'll try to answer that. I can tell you that I don't know that there are any efforts presently regarding Afghan and Ukrainian immigrants, but I'm sure that there will be, and I'm sure that they can take advantage of some of the things that are offered already. I know that in past years, we have had programs at least, and this is a campus-by-campus initiative, Saul. So each campus, for instance, the University of Wisconsin at Stevens Point, has a program set up where they will recruit different groups that are coming into our campus. And I think that one example, at least I can give you here in Eau Claire, is the Hmong population that came probably now in 35 to 40 years ago. And we had many families settle in Eau Claire. And as time went on, their young children became eligible to go to college. And I know that UW-Eau Claire recruited many, many of them. And I'm proud to say that some of them now, one of them in particular is a lawyer here in Eau Claire, Mai Vu Zhang, who is an extremely great business lawyer, who is a first generation college graduate and then went to law school at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. So we have those initiatives in place at the various campuses. I can't speak to each campus because I don't know what each campus does, but I know, as I said, that here in Eau Claire, we have that going on regarding the Hmong community. I know that that we reach out to, the campuses reach out to various different countries where they have relationships with and try to exchange students so that our students, for instance, from Wisconsin, get more knowledge about a global kind of education about how people live and think. And those students from the countries that come to UW-Eau Claire or any other university system campus learns about our cultures and our thought process and how things are done in this country. And I think that's absolutely necessary to help us in many different areas, as you might suspect, Saul. So a very good question. I think we'd be missing an opportunity if we didn't do that. And I believe we are doing that.
Saul, thank you for that. Along those lines, Ricardo now in Madison. Hi, Ricardo.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
One of the questions that I have is, do you know the percentage of either DACA or undocumented students who are attending UW universities? And then kind of like a follow-up to that is, would this be the perfect time to change the way they do business in regards to get enrollment dates higher by providing this population in-state tuition and not out-of-state tuition?
Ricardo, thank you for that question.
Okay, well, Ricardo, thank you for the question. I personally, as I sit here, don't know the percentage of DACA students that are on our campuses. I'm sure maybe someone has that down at the system offices. They seem to have statistics on almost everything, but I can't answer that right now. I don't know. But as to changing things, I think you should know that the regents are talking about different ways to help people get to campus. And one of those would be to consider this sort of idea to offer certain things to different people. I think I know that we're concerned about people that live in the state of Wisconsin and making education affordable for them. Every single group in this, these sorts of ideas are being talked about, and we have to continue to talk and try to implement those things. For instance, the Madison campus has Bucky's Promise, which we're talking about trying to implement on all our campuses. And Bucky's Promise is a great vehicle for having people whose household income is below $60,000 get their tuition free. And so I believe that's what it is. I hope I didn't misspeak there. I'm trying to recall exactly what it is, but Bucky's Promise is something that helps, whether it's free or a minimum, minor, lower amount of tuition.
I want to jump in here because out-of-state students without scholarships, they do pay higher tuition rates than in-state students. By increasing the number of out-of-state students, therefore, you're able to increase tuition revenue. So how do you balance that? Should the state be allowing more in-state students, even if that means raising tuition?
Well, here's the way I understand that works, and this is at the Madison campus. I don't know that it is at the other campuses, although it may be, so I'm not trying to misspeak or give you misinformation, but let's just talk about the Madison campus. The Madison campus can recruit and accept more out-of-state students who pay a higher tuition, no question about it. The regents were concerned that that would mean that less or fewer Wisconsin students would be admitted. And so we came to an agreement with them that a certain percentage of each incoming class had to be from Wisconsin. And it was more than had been formally admitted. And the Madison campus has admitted Wisconsin students at a higher rate each year, and also has increased the number of out-of-state students. So there is a, we have, and by the way, when you talk about raising tuition, we haven't raised tuition in Wisconsin for in-state students for 10 years.
Should the tuition freeze end for undergraduates?
Well, you know, we're talking about Wisconsin students, right? We're not talking about out of state. Is that your question?
Well, I was just wondering how you feel about that tuition freeze. Should it end?
The way I feel about the tuition freeze is this. I think that that we don't want to raise tuition on the Board of Regents. We hope that that is not continued, that it is raised in the future. We hope it isn't. We hope for more state funding to help us to pay for the certain things that tuition would typically pay for, instead of having our citizens of the state of Wisconsin pay more tuition. As a matter of fact, we were given by the legislature the power to once again raise tuition last summer. And you may note that we did not do that. We did not raise tuition because that's not what we want to do. An example of the state helping is just what Governor Evers just recently announced in his State of the State address, in that he was filling in the tuition freeze with money from the state of Wisconsin that he had
10 seconds.
Available. And so we would like us to not raise tuition, but there's something that is talked about. Sure.
President Menideets, thank you for joining us.
No problem. My pleasure.
Edmund Menideets, president of the UW System Board of Regents. And we should note, Wisconsin Public Radio is part of the UW System. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.